Today in Not Enough Champagne, we're looking at who voted for Brexit in the referendum. So I thought we'd start by looking at different groups of people and seeing on average whether they voted leave or whether they voted remain. So for instance, Steve, if someone was age 32, how would they have voted in the referendum?
Age 32, generally younger, so I would say remain.
Yeah, you're right. So these figures are taken from Lord Ashcroft's poll done the day after. And yeah, 25 to 34 year olds, 62% of them voted remain. What if you had a degree?
Well, if you had a degree, you voted remain.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the three factors we're going to look at that was crucial in the Brexit vote, is if generally the more educated voted for remain, and generally if you were less educated, you voted for leave. What if you said that you paid little or no attention to politics?
My gut instinct says you voted leave, but that could just be my own little biases showing there.
You're right. 58% of people who said they paid little or no attention to politics voted leave. What if you define yourself as a Christian?
Oh, Christ.
No, just Christian.
I have no idea. Like, the people that I know who were actually, like, kind of devout Christians, like my aunt and uncle, voted to leave. I know that. But I don't know if they're representative, so I'll go with leave.
Was, yeah. Again, 58% of those who said they were Christian voted leave. What if you supported the death penalty?
I would assume you voted to leave.
Yeah, you voted to leave, and that's probably something we'll talk about. What if you think that life was better today than 30 years ago?
Life is better today than 30 years ago, you'd be more likely to remain.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you thought life is better now than 30 years ago, you voted remain. If you think it was better 30 years ago, you voted to leave. What if you expected remain to win? How would you have voted?
Now, this is going to be one of those potentially counterintuitive things, or potentially I'm just overthinking it.
That's never happened.
It's never happened in my life. Okay, so I think that if you think that Remain was more likely to win, you were more likely to vote leave, because the people who would think that Remain was going to run away with it wouldn't have turned out.
You're kind of right and you're wrong. I mean, technically it is both, because 7 out of 10 people expected Remain to win. But that also includes 54% of Leave voters. What we're going to be looking at today are three main issues. There's lots of different postmortems that have been done on the Brexit vote. There's one by the Resolution Foundation, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation have done them. There's an Electoral Society one as well we'll talk about in our forthcoming episode on the rise of political bullshit. But these postmortems, they find three factors that were most important in people wanted to take back control. And these were these three factors were education, there were living standards, and immigration. And they're what we're going to talk about today. So the Resolution Foundation found that education was the best predictor of how you were going to vote in the referendum. 15 of the 20 least educated areas voted leave, and all 20 of the highest educated areas voted remain. And this isn't just in the UK, this is Europe-wide as well. So if you have a look at Euroscepticism across different European countries, if you're not as well educated, you're more likely to want to leave the European Union. This isn't because people are stupid or what have you. There's a couple of reasons for this. One of them is perhaps cultural. There's some evidence that maybe if you're more educated, you have a more liberal, a more cosmopolitan outlook that would make you more likely to vote remain. I think education's interesting because education touches on a lot of other factors. So it could be about pay.
I think it's much more likely to boil down to pay And kind of like income and how that kind of impact kind of links into kind of like living standards and things like that, rather than somehow, you know, the more educated they get, the more liberal you necessarily get.
It's the what we could call the left behind by globalisation. So there's social issues like the death penalty we talked about in the introduction. The Lord Ashcroft pod also found if you think feminism is a force for ill, you're more likely to vote Leave. If you think that multiculturalism or the Green Movement are forces for ill, you're more likely to vote Leave. What's more important are, I think, the opportunities you have in your area. Actually, although education is a big factor, that's more because it's a knock-on on other factors. So, for instance, if you're a graduate in a low-skilled community, you're more likely to vote for Brexit. And what's interesting, I think, are A-levels. So A-levels obviously are a bit of a middle ground between those kind of lower skill areas and degree level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have A-levels and you're in a low-skilled area, you were more likely to vote Leave. And if you had A-levels and you lived in a higher-skilled area, you're more likely to vote Remain. And so what evidence from the Resolution Foundation and the Joseph Ferrandi Foundation seems to suggest is that this is about opportunity. If you think that you could make progress, then you would vote Remain. If you didn't, if you felt left behind, then you would vote to Leave. It's those kind of, it's that educational inequality. And we'll talk a little bit about living standards in a second. So, in terms of that educational inequality, what I think is interesting is the way in which Theresa May is talking about addressing educational inequality is by bringing back grammar schools, which is surely just going to entrench any educational inequality rather than try and address it in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of grammar schools. They don't actually deliver on social mobility. All the evidence is quite clear on that. Yes, they do help like specific individuals. There is no denying that. If you are one of the lucky few who is from a poorer background and ends up in a grammar school, yeah, you will do better because of it. That is undeniable for the most part. But they don't help. The benefits aren't systemic. Is the thing. It helps a few. Whilst condemning everybody else to potentially a second grade.
And it's those few winners that drive the media narrative in a lot of cases. I mean, we talked a little bit about universities and how, because often politicians and journalists have their formative years at university, we tend to overrate university
as being an important part of life, yeah.
And I think the same thing happens with grammar schools. With Theresa May, it seems quite a personal thing. You know, she's giving interviews to the Daily Mail saying that grammar schools made me what I am today. And so there's this idea that because grammar schools worked for me, they can work for everyone, forgetting the fact that, as you say, most people are left behind. And that's why grammar schools got scrapped. Anyway, public opinion was against them in the 50s and 60s because it was okay if you got into a grammar school, but most people didn't, and they were the people left behind.
Yeah, so grammar schools are an interesting example of, I think, kind of cultural memory or cultural memory loss in this instance, where all of the people who were against them were the parents of the people who were actually the middle class parents, for the most part, who couldn't afford to go private, weren't able to quite get into the school, into the grammar schools, and so we're left with crummy secondary moderns. And as such, they kicked off about it when they realised their darling little Johnny and Jane weren't getting a good education because they had flunked one test. And that's one of the reasons why grammars were scrapped, was because there was pressure from the middle, in effect, the lower middle classes to kind of get rid of it. And I think as those kind of people have become less prevalent in terms of the political discourse, you've now got at the top, you've now got the likes of people like Theresa May, who were the lucky few who did get into those grammar schools and did do well out of it, calling the shots, and a number of people who are kind of age who, you know, we're in Birmingham, there are still kind of like grammar schools in Birmingham, there's a few of them. But from out most of the country, they're just a thing which was in the past. And, you know, on a kind of high level, that there's a logic there which is quite seductive. And I think because people have kind of forgotten what they actually did, then the people are a bit more in favour of them. I think if you were to bring them back, you know, give it 10 years, they'd probably be coming to get rid of them again.
I think it would be a cruel irony if people who are lower skilled, who feel left behind by that lack of opportunity, if they wanted to take back control to try and address in some way that kind of inequality, that lack of opportunity, which leads to a prime minister taking control who brings in grammar schools and entrenches that academic inequality. But I think that's education, and that was the biggest determinant in how people voted was education. But related to that, as we've suggested, are living standards. And again, this comes from the Resolution Foundation report, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation report, that they find living standards matter. For instance, the Resolution Foundation found that if you have an area with high unemployment, it's more likely to vote Leave. And if you had an increase of 10% in the employment rate, you had a decrease in a Leave vote by about 1-2%. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that the poorest households, those who have a household income below 20 grand a year, who have unemployment and low skills, they all voted to Leave, basically. And again, that is those left behind from globalisation. It's the ones without qualifications and without opportunities.
I have to say, I think with some of this, it may not be just down to necessarily them being left behind, but them feeling like that they are perceiving themselves and their areas being left behind. A-level, like we were talking about A-levels, generally speaking. You know, an A-level is worth an A-level. It doesn't matter where you are, whether the area is good or bad, or it's economically strong or economically weak. The problem is that there's not necessarily the perception is that if you're in an area that's economically poor, say, and you've got a choice between, and the employer has a choice between someone with the A levels or somebody with the degree, they'll go for the person with the degree because they're better equipped, quote unquote, for whatever the work is. So even though the things have stayed the same, it's just the perception of it all.
Where you live is important, partly because of that, but also, as we've said, if you're a graduate in a low-skilled area, you are more likely to vote Leave as well. So where you live is very important because of the opportunities in that area. So in Scotland, even with the factors we've talked about, with the education, living standards, what have you, the Leave vote was still substantially down on the English average in those kind of areas. It was 12%. The Leave vote was 12% lower in Scotland and England in those kind of areas, even if you take all the kind of living standard stuff into account. Whereas one of the reasons why Remain didn't win is because there wasn't that effect in London. There's no specific kind of Remain factor or London factor which led to an increase in the Remain vote. So I think you're right to some extent, but where you live, I think, is very important. And those kind of what we're going to talk about in this series of Taking Back Control is a lot of it is localism and how you can try and revive local areas, and maybe the localism agenda can be a way of trying to revive these areas where opportunities have been lost and often have been ignored by a London-centric government for the past 20 or 30 years.
I'm sorry, I forgot to bring the localism klaxon.
We'll have to bring it in next week. But also an analysis in the Financial Times, which last year found a link between lack of wage growth and the UKIP vote in 2015. And one thing that was obvious in the Brexit, when we did our Brexit post-mortem, is that we said that Remain took out all their experts, you know, the Mark Carneys of this world, lined them up and said there's going to be an economic Armageddon. But if you're in an area where you've missed out on prosperity over 10, 15 years...
Yeah, you feel like what could go worse? What could actually get worse?
Exactly. In many ways, it was more against the status quo and not just those kind of lack of opportunities. And I think that's the thing with living standards is it's a long-term trend. Although there was a strong relationship between income and Leave support, it wasn't necessarily income going down over the last few years. It's about the deep structural inequality that there is in Britain between London and the North, between the big cities and the rural areas. I mean, we talked about how Cornwall voted for Brexit despite all the EU money that it qualifies for. And a lot of that is probably because there aren't many opportunities. You know, you have to leave Cornwall if you want to try and have economic opportunity.
This, in many ways, is one of the kind of the core failings that a lot of the Conservatives in the past have had. Like, what was it? Was it Norman Tebbit? He said, get on your bike. To go somewhere else to work, in effect. And, you know, there's a logic to it, but people are a part of communities. They don't necessarily want to leave those communities. It's where their friends are. It's where their families are. And again, the people who are comfortable kind of doing that are the ones who are higher educated, who do have and are largely doing it because they've already gotten a good job and they're going somewhere else to get an even better one. So they know that everything's going to be fine.
And in fact, I think that point brings us nicely onto the immigration point, because the people who do get on their, not on their bikes, obviously, because, I mean,
it's quite difficult to bike to the Alps.
Yeah, well, it's quite difficult to bike over the English Channel. You know, they come on their boats and what have you. So immigration mattered in the referendum result, but I don't think it's in the way we think. I think a lot of the remembrance, certainly from a lot of the liberal intelligence you see on Twitter and Facebook, is that it was somehow a kind of vote by racists for racism. But I think the picture actually is a lot more nuanced than that. There's some interesting stuff from the Resolution Foundation, also British Futures, which is Sundar Kotwala's think tank. They've done some very interesting data on people's attitudes to immigration and immigration as it was used in the referendum. And what they found was that 64% of people thought that they were worried about the tone that the referendum took on immigration. They thought it became overheated. Maybe a good example of that is the infamous Breaking Point poster. So Nigel Farage stood in front of a poster with a load of Syrian immigrants, basically saying, we can't let them in, we're at breaking point. And 55% of people thought that this poster went too far. And that included 30% of Leave voters. So just caricaturing Leave voters as people who were one-eyed on immigration, one-eyed on refugees, I think is not right. Although generally, if you thought immigration was bad, you voted Leave, and if you thought immigration was good and voted Remain, there's a little bit of overlap between those two groups. So there's about a fifth of Remain voters who think that immigration was bad for the economy, but they still voted to Remain. Also about a fifth of Leave voters think immigration is good for the economy, but they voted to Leave.
Yeah, there is some interesting kind of like overlaps there. And I think for the kind of the Leave camp, it's a lot easier to explain. You've got your Dan Hannans of the world, Dan Hannan, the Conservative MEP for the South West, I think. It was basically one of the leading kind of Eurosceptic lights in the Tory party. But very much what I've seen described as a liberal leader, a liberal leaver. Not necessarily anti-immigration, but very much for him, it is all about kind of taking back control and about sovereignty and being able to say, we set the terms, we are able to determine who does and does not come in. You know, it hit the likes of him and Carswell, and Douglas Carswell, for instance, are fairly pro-immigration. You know, maybe not to the extent of other people, but they are not batten down the hatches, bring up the drawbridge, let no one in types. They're certainly not as anti-immigration as the likes of Theresa May.
No, who voted Remain.
Who voted Remain, for instance. So you do have these kind of mixed bags of supporters, which is why it's really important not to kind of draw too many generalisations about kind of Leave and Remain supporters, which is something which is happening, especially in my experience from what I've seen for supporters of Remain,
who are
continually at this point, or at least a significant number of them, certainly the vocal ones who are members of political parties, are starting to characterise or continuing to characterise all Remain or Leave supporters as racists.
We are the 48%.
Yeah, and it's just like, guys, that's why we lost, because we didn't listen to those claims. Yes, some of them were overblown. Yes, some of them were wrong. But in order to actually win an argument, you need to listen, not just shut people down.
No, so I think what's interesting is the pitch is quite nuanced, as you say. What the British Futures did is they got people to rank how good or bad immigration was in the economy from a scale of 1 to 10. And, you know, you got, it's a bit like a bell curve. You had 25% saying, you know, ranking it 1 to 3, it was awful. 25% saying it was awful, about 25% saying it was very, very good. Yeah. And then you got that middle 50% kind of ranking it between 4 and 8 out of 10. And of those middle 50%, saying immigration's neither good nor bad, kind of in the middle, 74% of those agreed with the statement that immigration brings gains and pressures. And you also have a situation in which 48% of people think politicians are too scared to talk about immigration, and 21%, just 21%, disagreed with that. But I think you can tell from the fact there's people like Dan Hannan, from the polling evidence, there's room for a nuanced discussion on immigration.
Absolutely, but you do actually have to have the courage to do it, and you need to be realistic about it, because the problem is, you either, the immigration debate
in the country at the moment goes one of two ways. You're either, you know, for lack of a better way of describing it, pandering to the Daily Mail and the Sun, kind of like the very right wing, very authoritarian, no immigrants, immigrants are bad, we need to cut the numbers down to tens of thousands, regardless of what the actual necessities or requirements are for Britain's economy to function. Or you've got, in effect, the Lib Dem and I think also the Green position, which is fling open the doors, come one, come all, bring us you're tired, you're hungry, you're poor, you're, and anybody who wants to come over and stay as well. You know, both of those are, have some logic behind them. Both of them are valid positions to hold. But when you've just got those two viewpoints as the only kind of discourse going around, you're just batting heads against each other and you're not going to get anywhere. All you're going to do is end up polarising people. What we do need is somebody to sit up, to sit down and say, for instance, immigration works. It is a good thing for our economy, but there are issues with it.
In terms of the narrative on immigration, I think there's two things that you need to talk about. One of them is culture and cohesion, mm-hmm. is that kind of integration. If you were more likely to think that those from different backgrounds get on well, you were less likely to vote Leave. So I think having a narrative based on that shared culture, you can talk about Mo Farah, you can talk about the people, you know, people like Adil Rashid, Moeen Ali, who are playing cricket for England. There's lots of the fact we've got a Muslim mayor of London. There's lots of factors you can make that positive case, which I think needs to happen more often. You've got a Muslim winner of Bake Off, for heaven's sake. I mean, I don't think there's anything more middle class and white British than baking cakes. So there's a narrative on culture, I think, to be made that needs to be made a bit more explicitly, like you're saying. And the other thing is addressing that impact that immigration does have in certain areas on services. So, for instance, in one thing the Resolution Foundation found is that in all areas where the number of migrants have increased by 7% in the last 10 years, all those areas voted Leave. And that was the key fact in which immigration was a factor. It wasn't necessarily the amount of immigrants or the amount of foreigners in your area. It was the amount of recent immigration. So areas like Peterborough, for example, they had a 7% increase in immigration and they voted to Leave by 61%. They're the kind of areas where immigration is legitimately having a pressure, and where if you had a well-funded migration impact fund, the kind of area where you need to have that fund in those areas, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, I think something else that is worth bringing up here is actually austerity. Rights or wrongs of austerity aside, and you can have your own opinion on that, whether it's the right course of action economically, the wrong course, or whatever. The fact is that an awful lot of kind of cuts that have been made in terms for government expenditure haven't come from central departments. They've come at local levels. So what you have in a number of these areas are an increase in population and a decrease in funding to deliver services. So that is a recipe for poorer services. You know, and it just so happens that that increase in population has come about from immigration. So this is one of the few instances where you could actually legitimately turn around and say that austerity has not helped this over the past 5 years or so. But you know, you won't hear me say that very often, because 90% of the time when people are blaming austerity for something, it's crap. But in this instance, you know, the cuts to local expenditure have had an impact, and you know, one of the easiest ways to actually ensure that you're not having these declines in service provision is to make sure that there's actual funding available, or that to fund the services properly.
What I'm worried about, and we've talked about the Lib Dem Green position, the Daily Mail position on immigration, is the Labour position now is quite confused. I say, as though that's a new thing. But, I mean, for instance, there's a Fabian pamphlet that's just come out with MPs like Rachel Reeves and Stephen Kinnock saying that if Britain cannot get any deal on freedom of movement and ending freedom of movement, they shouldn't sign up to the single market. I think that's a backward step. Labour now should be trying to sign up for single market and making a positive case for immigration in the way that you can, as you were saying it's a good thing. Yeah. And instead, I think to try and chase the UKIP vote, they are coming up with bad policy.
I think what you'll probably find very, very quickly in Labour is going to be a bit of a split. So I think you're going to see splits in Labour with the kind of the more metropolitan types pushing for kind of single market access. And then you're going to have the ones who are a bit more either from the kind of the more, for lack of a better word, traditional working class background pushing for leaving. And then you'll have the ones who are just looking at their seats and kind of going, oh shit, if these guys go Tory or go UKIP again, I'm fucked.
I think that's the thing, is that it's trying to work out the UKIP vote from the referendum fallout could really hurt Labour. And again, that's part of a wider conversation about the fact that Labour is politically screwed on a number of fronts.
Yeah.
I think what the evidence does show, what the polling shows, is that actually Britain is not as divided as we thought. It's certainly on immigration. We've talked a lot in our EU referendum podcast about how it felt like Britain were two tribes who didn't understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can tell that the fact that there's deep inequality on education, deep inequality on opportunities and standards of living, I think that shows there are two Britons. But it's not necessarily in the way that we think. It's not divided on immigration as much as just income inequality and structural inequality. But actually, although this feels like a massive defeat for the liberal left because we can't just go to Venice on our holiday when we want to, or we can't go on our Erasmus programme if we want to, actually there is a lot of political space on the centre left to try and address these inequalities. I mean, it should be quite heartening news for Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, I mean, one of the pieces of kind of polling that came out very quickly after the referendum, again, I think it might have been Lord Ashcroft's day of result kind of polling that was released. Immigration wasn't the top reason that people voted, that people stated that they wanted to vote for. That they voted for Leave. It was that kind of nebulous, let's take back control. And again, when you kind of dig into these kind of answers and the questions that have been asked, it does seem that there is a case to be made. It's still a pro-immigration case that can be made. It's just it needs to be done in the right way.
Mm.
So, for instance, rather than just necessarily drawing a line in the sand and saying single market, access, freedom of movement for all, and kind of making that the battle line, to me, I think for like the left and the liberal left in particular, what they need to do is kind of scrap that as a battle line, put another thing back and say, we're good with that, that's fine. What we're going to push for is a liberal immigration system that we can control. Because here's the thing, as much as everybody's kind of, so much of the kind of like the Brexit Brigade, we're talking about the Australian system, for points migration and things like that. It's actually a pretty liberal system in a lot of ways. Once you hit those criteria, you're just in. So from the perspective of actually bringing in people that are going to be beneficial to the country, from the perspective of enabling people to actually come here and work effectively, you know, they don't even necessarily need to have a job when they turn up. They just need to have the skill set.
Mm.
So you can bring people in really easily under that system. Which is one of the reasons Theresa May is against it, by the way, is because it is really easy for people to get in.
I suppose it depends how you set it up then and how, and what skills you want, what skill sets you want.
But it gives you something where you are able to fall back and line the defences and fight for something which enables you to still have a liberal migration system, which isn't battening up the hatches and drawing up the drawbridge.
And I think this is something, it's something we've talked about off air but haven't really talked about in on air, is trying to fight this war rather than the last war. And one thing I think we didn't talk about in the episode last week on the Labour leadership is that Owen Smith was trying to say he was more electable than Corbyn, despite the fact that his main policy difference was a second EU referendum, and which is just nonsense. I think it's about trying to find a new settlement. It's about actually realising that the vote did happen. It was a toss-up, it was close, but it happened, and there is a problem with these people who want to take back control.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode of Not Enough Champagne, then please make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever it is that you get your podcast from. If you are on iTunes, then please leave us a review. And rate us. The more people that review and rate us, the more people will find it, and the more listeners we'll get. So thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm @PaperbackRioter. Steve is @CentreRadical. Goodbye.
Goodbye.